Let's get started. Please, thank you everyone for coming this evening. Bereshit, Rabbi Davis. I thought I saw Rabbi Weinstock here. Maybe he'll be coming back. And all the other Rebbeim. And everyone that's here, welcome. We're here to give Mazel Tov to Tova Stern. No, we're here to hear Rav Nissel, but we would be remiss if we did not just say a few quick words about Jeanette and Masha, in whose memory and for the elevation of their neshama, we're having the shiur. So this is the time of year we all recall that Jeanette was nifter and Masha soon thereafter. And I'm not even qualified to say much on the subject, but nobody else wanted the job. So I would just like to say we all remember Masha as somebody who really lit up a room, always positive, despite very often having a tough situation. She was a regular visitor to our community and was always a very important and lively part of our community. And she is dearly missed. And of course, maybe hitting closer to home, is our recollections of Jeanette. And, you know, I think it's appropriate that we're hearing from Rabbi Nissel this evening about the idea of Ohel Avraham Basara, the idea of what it means to create a Jewish home and create, through an amazing marriage, to create amazing children and a legacy. And I think we all can very much testify to the fact that that was the case with Jeanette and Norman, unquestioned in the way that they opened their home, in the way they conducted themselves, were leaders in our community, and they left a legacy, as we said, you know, a few years back, in the form of their family, their children, but also, you know, it all came from Mrs. Himmelstein, who is still an amazing rock and so wonderful and welcome in our community. We're frankly honored to have you here this evening. And so it should be that the elevation of the neshamot of Masha ben Reb Yisrael Yitzchak and Chaya Kadelka, but Reb Yisrael Yitzchak, that they should, the neshamot should soar higher as a result of the Torah that we learned this evening. In their memory, we are very much indeed honored to have Rav Nissel back in the community. Jamie and I have stayed in touch over the years. It's not such a big thing. We come to find out in the Jewish world because everybody stays in touch with Rav Nissel. Okay. Well, that's only one of us guys makes the food. I'm just good at eating it. But
I met Jamie, but I was going to say that.
I figured. Rav Nissel is, I don't think you'll mind me saying, he is more or less the equivalent in today's parlance of a rock star in the seminary world. Certainly, you don't go to a...
Don't call me my wife, right?
Hi, Debbie. Hi, Revitin. In the seminary world, when you learn, if you learn seriously and you learn in a way that is with Tevekut and seriousness, you get into a shiur with Rav Nissel. And, you know, God willing, as my daughters are growing older, they're coming to that age, we hope that'll be the case for them. What a lot of people don't know is that Rabbi Nissel is also very prominent and very well regarded in the broader Jewish world in lecturing, including NCSY and just a whole host of places. Kiruv, I know, is very close to the rabbi's agenda, and he's really truly a master in many things. So we were really quite honored to have him here a few years ago as the Path Scholar Residence, and when we found out he was coming back to South Florida, we grabbed him for at least one night. So please welcome Rav Nissel.
Just before I begin, I would just like to say over what I said to someone on Shabbos. NCSY brought me in to do a Shabbaton in North Miami Beach. And I mentioned to someone who, one of the kids was from Hollywood, I said, it's interesting because this is like the tips, this is what's happening. I'm not a dancer, you know. Okay. And I mentioned something from the bottom of my heart, which is true. I go all over the country, and I see different communities, and I love Jews everywhere, but there are very few communities which I recommend to young couples to move in if they're young couples that want a community that is warm and that is friendly and where they can continue to grow in their Yiddishkeit. So I always mention the Davises, Rabbi Davises and Rebbetzin, and what they built over here is something incredible. So you may forget it because you live here, so you just take for granted how much is going on over here. So I just want to give you a big yeshikah and thank you again. I also want to thank Jamie and Menashe and Lisa, who's not even here tonight, for being so magnanimous in putting up with me. Now, this is a private joke between the three of us over here, but we just sort of, things got messed up a little bit with our emails and back and forth. And you guys were just like there for me, and you're great, and you're always there for me. And Baruch Hashem, you don't bring me in. We're friends, so it makes it so much easier, and I really, really do appreciate. And this class is going to go quickly because I'm having dinner afterwards. one last thing is that I'm just hearing now a little bit more about what an honor it is for me. Wow. Okay, what an honor it is for me. When it's not just... Wow. Okay. What an honor it is to me to... I just want to say one more time that this class is in memory of Chayachet Elka Bas Yisrael Yitzchak and Masha Bas Yisrael Yitzchak, Jeanette Levine and Michelle Himmelstein. It is an honor for me to be speaking in their precious memories, and let's hope that the Torah that we learn will indeed be Le'il Nishmasam. I want to begin with a very, very, very disturbing story. And for those of you that are tired and those of you that want to fall asleep, you will not, after you hear the story. This is disturbing. I'm not sure this is a good story to begin with, but the story happened last year, and it happened in Harnof, which is my neighborhood where I live in Jerusalem. And for some of you actually know Harnof, where I live, so you know that there's a thing called Osher Ad. Osher Ad is this huge, big, how do you describe it? It's like the aisles of just like, I don't know, like the sweets and chocolates and candy sections seem to go on forever and ever. You've been there? Okay, so you're there over there. It's like, I did not know there's so many different washing powders that exist, but it just goes on forever. It's this massive, massive, how do you describe it in America? A Costco. Okay, it's a Costco kind of thing. Osher Ad, it's a big chain. To be really, really, really honest, I've been there only once, and that was actually just recently. My wife had surgery, so I had to go and do shopping, which was an experience for me. My wife kept on saying, stay away from the candy section. It did not help. But Osher Ad goes on forever and ever, and that's where people go before the Chagim for the festivals to do their shopping. And the following story happened. Sukkot a year ago, just a year and a half ago, this story happened. There was a young couple with little kids. The husband was in chinuch, was in education, and he got laid off. And he was a very proud young man and very proud of his craft, and he insisted that he would find employment, but he did not. And the weeks turned into months, and the months, well, rolled on, and the money that this young couple had was slowly dwindling away. Until this following thing happens. This is tragic that these things happen in real life, but the festival of Sukkot came around, and they literally were penniless. And they wanted to buy food for the festival. So one thing they had, let me rephrase, one thing that the wife of the house had was tremendous, tremendous faith in Hashem. Pure, simple, old-time faith. And she said something, by the way, do not do this, in your own backyard. This is just the story as it went. And she said to her husband, look, we don't have any money, but we have to go and get stuff for the chag. What I want you to do is go to Osher Ad and just go and fill up as if we have all the money in the world. And I will sit at home and I'll say Tehillim, I'll say the Psalms, and I'll daven, and I'll pray, and I'll pray, and I'll pray, and I'll pray, and Hashem will take care of us. He always does. So, she looked at him and said, Senorita é loco. Senora é loco. I don't know how to say it in Portuguese, but you're crazy, crazy woman. And she says, no, 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 it's going to work out. And he knew that his wife was this holy woman that was very into prayer. And he says, okay. So he goes to Osherat, and he takes on these massive trolleys, and he starts to go as if he has all the money in the world, and he's buying meat, and he's buying fish, and he's buying thing, and the candy section, and the challah section, he's going through the whole thing. And in his wallet is a credit card that can no longer be covered anymore because everything will bounce, and not a single penny to his name. And he is terrified about waiting in line, and this is Erev Yom Tov, these long lines to go and pay, and then tell the person, the lady, the cashier, and whatever, then in Oshirat, old Russian, where is your credit card? And say, I don't have a credit card. So eventually, he's messed up as much as he can, and he has to wait in line, and he's waiting in line, and he's literally, his heart is thumping all over because he doesn't have a penny, and he's about to be really, really embarrassed. So he keeps on calling his wife every few minutes, and he hears it going, you know, did the miracle happen yet? She's stuffing away, and she said, did the miracle happen? And he says, no, there's been no miracle. And he waits in line, and slowly but surely he's getting towards the cashier. And then, finally, he gets to the cashier, and he literally has an anxiety attack. He goes crazy, he doesn't know what to do, he's about to unload everything, and he suddenly turns to everyone around and says, I forgot something very important, and he rushes back, and he looks for something fictitious that he doesn't even need, and he comes back, and meanwhile the person behind him starts screaming and says, you know, this is Erev Yom Tov, do you think we have time to wait for you the whole time? And this is it, it's all he needs. Not only does he have money, but people are shouting at him, and he's red-faced, and his heart is going boom, 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 and he starts to take out one by one, this item, that item, the fish, and the meat, and whatever it is, and the wine, and everything he bought for Yom Tov. And it's piling up, and the cashier is written the register, and he doesn't have a penny to his name. He has no idea what's going to happen. And she says, okay, so this is the amount that it costs, whatever, it's, $2,500 shekel, and he goes into his wallet, and he's about to pass out. And then suddenly, the hand of God appears. This is happening in Osherat in Haranof, 5 minutes from where I live. Hand appears with a credit card and said, this one's on me. So the cashier says, are you sure? He says, yeah, I'm sure. And he turns round, and he sees that behind him is that guy that was screaming and shouting at him and telling him, why are you making us wait? And he said, I felt terrible. I had no right to scream and shout at another Jew. I didn't judge you favorably. It's Erev Chag. And instead of apologizing to you, I want to apologize by paying for your Chag grocery. Okay, so this guy, can I handle this? He takes everything, he goes out, and he collapses in a heap outside in the parking lot, and he starts crying like a baby. And meanwhile, the person behind him has paid for his groceries. He comes out, and he sees the person that he just helped out, he's crying in a corner. So he goes up to this person and says, I'm sorry, what do you want from me? I paid for your groceries. Why are you so upset? He says, you don't understand, this is a miracle. He says, what are you talking about? See, he told him what had just happened. And this guy looks at him and says, you are insane. He says, I don't believe for one moment anything you're saying. This is the most stupidest thing I've ever heard. He says, it's true. He says, give me your phone. He grabs his phone. He presses redial. And he listens in, and he hears the woman going, da, 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 da. Has the miracle happened yet? And this guy's like, whoa, he was so overwhelmed. He could not believe this was happening. And at that point then, he said, okay, I see what's happening over here. You people are not normal, but I just want to make sure that you are taken care of. He takes out his checkbook, and he writes 11 checks for the next year, each one for 2,500 shekel, and he says, I want to make sure that you guys have groceries for the year. And that's how the story ends. Now, the story is disturbing for many reasons. I actually said this over at an NCSY event last year when I first heard it, and I asked the kids, who's the hero of the story? Is the what?
Wife.
The wife with the prayers? The husband who's the martyr? The guy doing the chesed? The guy writing the checks over here? And I have no idea. It's not for me to judge. But what I can say is that what was happening over here is something that only happens to us Jews. I don't know what it is. It's something very Jewish. It's disturbing. It's a little bit disturbing, this whole thing about poverty in Israel, which we're not going to talk about now. But in general, the story is something you see over here, extreme levels of simple faith, which I'll be very honest with you, my wife and I do not relate to. This is levels, I don't think I'm trying to preach what this woman was doing. I don't relate, my wife doesn't relate, but I know that there are people that live this way. And the extreme levels of chesed, the magnanimous, a person insulted someone else, he felt he should do something about it, and he writes, and then he realizes what's going on, and he immediately turns into real life chesed, and doesn't just wait for things to happen, he turns this into action. There's something incredibly Jewish about what we do, and this is something that is, we are an insanely beautiful people. I just have to say this over. The more I think about it, this year, I've been, I don't want to talk about my father who passed away, although I could spend the next hour talking about him, but my father, he helped out during the war, the Halberstam family. So I just recently started reading up about the Halberstam family, and there is this Klausenberger Rebbe, who was a person who suffered tremendously during the war. And there was one point when, this was in one of the camps, he went from camp to camp during the Holocaust, in one of the camps that he was in, one of the Nazis recognized that he was a that he was an important rabbi. They saw how everyone else was treating him. So he got specific treatment of sadism. Now, the day that he received the sadism was the day of Simchas Torah, and the Rebbe knew of Simchas Torah. And this guy was whipping him on his feet, and he basically broke the Rebbe's legs. And he left him in a pile of blood, and he sent everyone else to work. And everyone thought that they're going to find the Rebbe dead. And they didn't. They found that he was just could no longer walk anymore. So what did the Rebbe do? The Rebbe asked to be raised up, and he said to everyone, he said to him, listen, today is Simchas Torah, the mitzvah is to dance. I want you to dance with me by holding my hands. And that's not the great part of the story. Because many years later, he said over to family members that while he was being beaten, he decided to have revenge on the Nazis that were beating him up. So when you and I think about Jewish revenge, so what does it mean, Jewish revenge? This, how does a Rebbe do revenge? And he said over, this is the way the Hasidim said over, he decided while he was being beaten up that his revenge would be that he was going to build a hospital when he gets out from the Holocaust, and that hospital would service Jews and non-Jews, so that non-Jews can benefit from Jewish charity, and that would be his revenge against Nazi sadism. And I ask you, if there's any other nation like the Jewish people that can think that way, just to think that way. So these are stories that we all know. These are stories that you can probably share with us from here in this own community. But it does go back to two people. And those two people are Abraham and Sarah. Everything we have, everything that makes us unique and special, the so-called Jewish stories that only we can have, the stories that any other community would look at and say these things cannot possibly happen. The reason why we have these stories is because it goes back to two people, Abraham and Sarah, Avram and Sarah. The first couple, the ones that built and laid down the foundations of absolutely everything that we have. Why did I call this class the Abraham and Sarah, the prototype of the Jewish home, because Rabbi Yonasan ben Uziel, the great commentator on the Chumash, he taught us this, and he tells us something that is absolutely mind-blowing. When a young couple gets married, I'm looking over the young couples, who's the youngest couple over here? When you guys got married over there. So, everyone wish you, you should build a bais Naaman b'Yisrael. What is a Naaman? What does Naaman mean? Naaman means that your Jewish home should imitate the ancient Jewish temple. It's the way it goes, just like the word emunah, built on the same foundations as the Jewish temple. So every Jewish home is a microcosm of the Jewish temple. So we know that. What we forget, says Rabbi Yonasan ben Uziel, is that the Jewish temple was in turn based on the Jewish home. Which Jewish home? Abraham and Sarah. How do we know this? because the Mishkan, the original tabernacle, was built with this magic wood that would connect every single part of the Mishkan, of the tabernacle, of what was called the prototype of the Jewish temple. And perfect timing. It's just the class is just beginning now. It's just starting to get interesting. And this wood had to come from somewhere. They were in the middle of the desert. Says Rabbi Yonatan ben Uziel, the wood came magically, brought over by angels, came from the home of Abraham and Sarah. Abraham and Sarah's home was literally, physically used to build the Jewish temple. So I ask you, is your home being built on the Jewish temple, or is the Jewish temple being built on your home? Because your home has its roots in the home of Abraham Avinu and Sarah Imenu. So when Menashe and Jamie invited me to speak, and I'm thinking to myself, what's this week's parsha? It's Chaya Sarah. So we're just now finishing the stories of Abraham and Sarah, and it's time for us to reflect and say, what can we learn from Avraham Avinu and Sarah Imenu and somehow apply it to our lives? So we've got to focus on basically 10 points. Each one of them is very, very intimately connected to every other point, but it gives us a picture of what a Jewish home is all about. So yesterday, as I mentioned, I was with the NCSY kids. And yesterday we had another Jewish moment. We had a bar mitzvah. It was very nice. NCSY had a bar mitzvah. Okay, so he was 17 years old. And he only found out he was Jewish last week. But this is an NCSY moment. This is what we do. So it was very moving. It was very exciting. And yeah, I got something out of it because I was the only person there stealing the candies. So no, I like kids like those firebomb things. I don't know what it is. Okay, but the part, yeah, it's kind of embarrassing. But yeah, because no one else has a place.
It's Target. We'll get a whole box.
Yeah, it's sort of embarrassing. It was hiding in my Telus bag. Anyhow, the point is that right then Rabbi Shapiro comes in. He's the Rav of Shari Tfilo, I think it's called. He comes in. Never heard him speak, but I know he's supposed to be an incredible speaker. And he gets up and he says, I want to give a blessing to the bar mitzvah boy. 17-year-old fellow. What was the blessing? Crazy blessing. I never heard this before. It's such a beautiful, beautiful idea. He says, we all know that a Jewish marriage has its halachic roots in the sale of Maris Machpelah. So I don't want to get technical on everyone, but everyone that went to yeshiva had to figure this whole thing out. It seems like when you get married, so there's called an acquisition going on. I don't want to get technical because it sounds, yeah, Jamie, you're not going to like this, okay? Your husband gave you a ring, so he was basically doing the same thing if he was buying batteries in Best Buy. But it's not exactly that way because, you know, thank God the rabbi walked out now, but really it's not that way. You didn't give, it is a spiritual exchange. And basically, what the husband is buying is what's called in halachic terms your ishus. In other words, there's a part of you that you give over to your man, and that's what happens at that moment of marriage. Where do we know this from? We know it from the sale of Maris Machpelah when Ephron, who's one of the nastiest people in history, managed to do the ultimate con artist, managed to get 400 silver coins out of Abraham to be able to buy this little piece of real estate. Okay, so ask Rabbi Shapiro, okay, what's going on? Who cares about the sale of a little piece of real estate? What's it got to do with the beauty of a Jewish marriage? And he said something that I never heard this before, so I have to, my first chance to say it over. He said, let's picture the scene at the moment of the sale. Ephron, this rascal, this good-for-nothing rascal, this basically this con man, is looking at Abraham and saying, Jewish sucker. He says, I just got the deal out of the century. I'm selling him a bunch of rubble, a bunch of stones, for 400 silver coins. It's like a fortune. So he's thinking he's getting the best deal of the century. Meanwhile, Abraham, Avraham Avinu, is thinking exactly the same thing. He says, poor Ephron, he is clueless to what I'm buying. This is the holiest piece of real estate on the planet after Jerusalem. This is the second holiest place in the world. It's Hebron. This is the place where the word Hebron literally means connection, where heaven and earth meet. I know this. Ephron can never figure this out. 400 silver coins, it's a steal. It's worth billions. It's worth an infinity. And all I'm paying is 400 silver coins. So think about it. Both sides are thinking, what an incredible deal. How fortunate I am to get what I'm getting. That's the foundation of the Jewish marriage. Where everyone looks into the other one's eyes and says, wow, boy, did I do well. Why was I lucky? So it's beautiful. I just want to add one thing. You could, Rabbi Shapiro wasn't going to say this because it wasn't a marriage class, but you can only say that if simultaneously you follow it up with what Rav Dechter says, and therefore I wish to give the other person in my life as much as I can to show my appreciation of how lucky I am. In other words, it's my brother-in-law who was a rabbi in England used to say under the chuppah, marriage is not about give and take, it's about give and give and give and give, period. Each side is focused on the other one to give as much as we can. So let's go and see what happens with Avram and Sarah and see the dynamics of their marriage, because the Torah speaks openly about the stuff that went on in their marriage, and nothing is black and white. Nothing is as simple as it seems. So I want to start off and say, number one, what is the first principle of a Jewish marriage? I'm sure you guys thought about it. Usually exhibit A. This is so cute. How long did you get married?
2.5 years ago.
Okay, that's not so exciting anymore. Okay. So, okay. So, at this point, you guys are veterans. I'm sorry. Okay. It's all over with. But the point is that when my seminary students and yeshiva students, I teach in yeshivas as well, whenever they ask me, when am I ready to get married? So I always say two things. Number one is you have to understand what a relationship is all about, which I'm not going to talk about. That's what exactly that means. But the other thing I say is what I think needs to be stated much more, because so many young couples just don't think about it, and many married couples have forgotten about this, is that you're not just getting married. Your marriage is that each of you are contributing to build what's called a bias. So 1 and 1 does not equal 2. 1 and 1 equals a bias, something infinitely more than the sum of your parts. And that bias has to stand for something. In other words, you don't just build without knowing what you're building. You have to believe in something. So, young couple, they have to be on the same page. And being on the same page means they have to share the same vision. They have to share the same dream. Which means, as I always tell people before they start dating, do you have a vision yet? Do you know what you want to build? So we have over here, Avram and Sarah is the classic Jewish home. Avram Avinu says, our home is going to be built on the valley called Chesed. Everything is going to be about our home to afford the opportunity that everyone around us can actually benefit from our home. So what do? They designed their home that it was open in 4 different directions. Most people have a front door. They had 4 front doors. As if to say, our privacy is secondary to the needs of our guests. And they built their home around Chesed. If anyone ever says to you, Abraham symbolized Chesed, you can tell them that's only half a sentence. It's always Abraham and Sarah. Whenever we talk about Avram Avinu being the Midah of Chesed, it means together with his wife. This, by the way, this is true in Kabbalah with all the, what's called the Sephirah, all the 7 shepherds, each one of them stood for something with their wives. It doesn't mean that Avram was Chesed and Sarah was Chesed. It is, as we're about to learn, Avram was Chesed and Sarah was Gvura to his Chesed. In other words, Sarah and Avram Avinu complemented each other. Each one played on each other's strengths. And that way, the Chesed of Abraham could actually work. But, when Sarah went into the marriage and Avram Avinu says, we're going to build it through Chesed, and Sarah said to him, I'm with you 100%, and I'm going to make sure that everything you do is going to be successful. And we're going to do this together. So Avram and Sarah, they actually stand for something. What I'm about to say to you now, you don't have to take literally, because it's very tongue-in-cheek, but sometimes I tell to young couples, I said, you know, there's 3 types of Jewish homes. There's Avram and Sarah, then there's Rivka and Yitzchak, and then there's Yaakov and Rachelah. Okay, whatever that means. A little awkward about how it sounds, but there we go. What do I mean? So the first home is like the Chesed home. So I always picture like the people that love to have a big Shabbat table. That's the way it goes. You have people that want to do, they always want to cure them and have guests over. It's just kind of a home that always wants to bring people in. So that's the Avraham and Sarah type of model. Yitzchak and Rivka, it's a different kind of a marriage. They're what I call the spiritual types. So sometimes you go to people's homes and you see, you know, before the husband makes kiddush, he looks into the candles and he gets a little watery-eyed as he makes his spiritual wishes, and his wife is going, oh, that's so beautiful, and whatever. I find these things nauseating. But the point is that this is it. There are certain types of people who are very, very spiritual in the whole thing, and people come out and they say, oh, I just want to move to Tzfat. And this is that. So, okay, but you know what? Power to you, sister and brother. If that's what you want, you've got your role model. Yitzchak and Rivka is where it all comes from. And finally, you have the third role model, which is Yaakov Avinu and Rachel / Leah. I know how incorrect that sounds, but the point is that what Yaakov and his wives did together is they built a home where the whole complete and total focus was one thing and one thing only, was on the children. Which means everything they did was to build 12 kids. Each one was perfect. Each one would become a future tribe, and together they would build Klal Yisrael. So you don't see that Yaakov has any focus with his wives outside the building of his children. So I'm just saying to you that you see three different models. Each one builds a home. Their home stands for something. They know they're trying to achieve something with their home. This is something we see from Avraham and Sarah. And I insist, this is a prerequisite before you're ready to get married. You got to know, what do you want to do? You're just getting married because it's going to be fun. You're going to marry it because, you know, it's for tax benefits or just whatever you can get out of it. You get married because you have a vision that your home stands for something. I want to say at this point now, again, I'm talking to a very, very, it's almost like preaching to the choir over here. But Menashe alluded to the fact that I spend up to 2 hours every night on email, sometimes even on Facebook and on Skype or whatever social media works for my students, helping them with their problems. There's a lot of problems out there, and unfortunately, as I tell my other friends always tell what marriages should look like, and I said, okay, you think you know about a marriage, I'm the one that has to fix all the stupid advice that you give to young couples. I know I have to fix it on later on. And there's a lot of stupid advice given out there. I just want to share with you something that I just went through last year. It's actually now more than a year ago, but I'm still dealing with the story over here. Had a student, and she was very, very successful in her career. And she pushed off her marriage until it was her late 20s, which is, I don't think, such a big deal. I know, I mean, I'm trying to be open-minded here. She was late 20s, and then she found another guy who was also very successful in his career, totally different career, and the two of them got married. And I said to them the following thing. I said, your marriage is not going to work unless you realize that the first year after your marriage, you've got to put your careers a little bit on hold, and you've got to focus on each other and focus on building your home. And they did not listen. They got married, and they didn't change anything. The whole lives revolved on their careers, and they sort of brought two babies into the world. And I knew that the marriage was on the rocks. And they told me, okay, so we're going to marital therapy. And I said to him, save your money. And marital therapy is so expensive. I, Menachem Nissel, will save you money on marital therapy. I'll give you my own solution. That's what you do. Okay, very, very simple idea. To get the therapist, the two of you get on a plane, go to some Caribbean island alone. And they said, yeah, that sounds like fun. We'll do that. And I said, but on one condition, leave behind your computers and your phones. Just the two of you have to go together, and all the stuff that connects you to your life, man, you've got to leave behind. And it was too hard for them. And they're divorced today. There's not a happy ending. Not all of my stories have happy endings, but this is they got divorced. But I'm telling you, this. I know this is being recorded, but I told this her in her faith. It didn't have to work out that way. All they had to do is when they got together and said, we're going to get married, they sort of asked them, what do we stand for? Our home has to stand for something. And that has to become the focus, not your career. I'm not knocking the career, but the career is the sideshow. The career is to feed in to the centerpiece of your life, which is building your Jewish home. So Avmir Sara, that's it. They had to earn whatever they were doing, but their focus, they knew exactly what they wanted to do with their home, and that's what they focused on 24/7, 365. That was the centerpiece. And everything else had to fit in with that plan. That's the first thing we learn for a successful marriage. Number two, staying focused on the big picture. Staying focused on the big picture, even when you're under pressure. So life doesn't always work out exactly how you want it, and crazy things happen. And Avram and Sarah get married, they move to the promised land, and then boom, before they know it, they find themselves in Egypt. And there, crazy things start to happen. So Sarah Maina is beyond gorgeous, and the Egyptian officers look at her, and they say, this is the original source of the phrase, she is out of our league. This is it. She can only go to the king. She can only go to Pharaoh. They looked at her and they understood this is something that actually these lowly Egyptians saw, that she radiated Malchus. She herself had this royalty about her. She had this inner shine, and they knew that she belonged to Pharaoh. So what does Avraham Avinu say? When you read the verses, he does not sound good. He says, Imri na chosiat. Okay, tell him I'm your brother. Okay, it's the brother sister of Pharaoh there, and just make sure I make lots of money out of the whole thing. That's what it says over here. So when you read the storyline, you say, "Uh-oh, this is not good. This sounds very abusive." Avraham Avinu sees an opportunity to make money out of his wife's body. That does not sound right, does it? So every single commentary tries to put Humpty Dumpty together again and explain what really is happening behind the scenes. The Maral of Prague does it, in my opinion, he does it, the most extraordinary information he gives. This is absolutely mind-blowing. Avram and Sarah had a vision. What was their vision? They knew, as the Rambam says explicitly, that everything that was happening to them was going to be the prototype of what's going to happen to the Jewish people in the future. So Avram and Sarah knew that they were role-playing what was called, they were the, so to speak, the spiritual seed that would come out as the fruit of the Jewish people in exile in Egypt. So Avram says to Sarah, we've got to take care of our kids over here. It is very, very, very important that our children, when they come out of Egypt, they take out the wealth of Egypt and they bring it to the promised land. Okay, so you read that and you say, so they wanted their kids to be rich. It's a nice Jewish concept. Let them come out and let them basically empty out Egypt and they can come out filthy rich. No, says the Maharal. That's not what they were doing. They were doing something, and again, I don't expect myself to understand these mystical, Kabbalistic concepts, but they understood the following thing. They understood that Egypt was the essence of evil in this world, and the Jewish people had a mission to take the evil of this world and to flip it over to something good. And therefore, the Jewish people emptying out Egypt of all its, so to speak, its physical wealth, is another way of saying to take what Egypt was and to flip it over from impurity to the world of purity, to turn it into something holy. The Jewish mission in this world is to take all the evil and to turn it round into something beautiful. This has to begin with the source of evil, which is Egypt. So what's happening over here? Avram and Sarah find themselves in Egypt. There's a lot of pressure going on. They're in a crazy situation. They get together and say, okay, let's figure out what's happening over here. And they see a big picture. They see a big picture of their children coming out of Egypt. They see ultimately a big picture until the end of time, when the Jewish people had this extraordinary challenge of taking all the evil in the world and to turn it into something beautiful and positive and holy. That is what they were thinking. So my second point is, not only do you need to stand for something, but you have to remember what you stand for, even when life starts to get crazy. So everyone's trying to think, oh my gosh, I'm just totally focused on the moment. No, you've got to step back. You and your spouse have to say to each other, we're not going to lose the plot over here. We're not just going to let life just happen. Okay, we're in Egypt, so now what? No, we've got to figure out, how does this fit in with the big picture, the strategic vision of our marriage plan? Everything has to fit in. Number three, I mentioned in passing, but let's go over this again. Each one has to ask themselves, how can I build my spouse? This is something in the Abraham-Sarah story. We see it more in one direction, but it clearly works in both directions. Sarah is very, very much focused on what Avraham Avinu is trying to do, to make sure that she is giving everything she can, that he should become what he's trying to be. So the holy books say something beautiful. I don't know, Dan, this is a little bit, I apologize a little bit that I'm not so entertaining anymore. I'm just going to give you all this technical information. But I just want you to know, this is Sarai Imenu. How amazing was she? What was her name? Sarai, right? That was her original name. Sin, Shin, Resh, Yud. And then she became Sarah with a hay at the end. Okay, where did she get the hay from? So the holy books say she had it all along. Because women have what's called the spiritual hay that they contain inside of her. The Isha and the Ish, a man carries inside of him a Yud, and a woman carries inside of her the letter hay. Hay is femininity, Yud is masculinity. Whatever. Okay, that's the way these things go. Hay and Yud, that's the way these things work. So, yeah, they would speak about it at Yeshiva Brachos. Didn't they mention it? When there's Shalom Bayis, then you, the Eish is the Eish of passion and love. But when the Yud and the Hey are gone, which is God's name, then it becomes the fire of destruction. Okay, great. Sarah has a Hey. So what does she do? She takes her Yud and her name, and she gives it to Joshua. Why? I'll let Rabbi Davis explain this when you get there. It's a whole discussion that what the Yud was doing. Yoshua was called Hoshea, he became Yoshua. What happened? Sarah says, my hay I give over to Abraham. So he became from Avram to Avraham. The hay of Avraham was given to her by Sarah. Okay, sacrifice for your husband. But there's more. You sound like a commercial. And there's more, if you pay that. Okay, the point is that what do you do with this extra hay? Rashi brings down on the verse, Eila tolda shemai v'aretz behibaram. This is the story of the creation world, behibaram, when it was created. Behibaram is the same letters as Avram. Avram is the foundation of the world. Wait a second. If you look at the same word, behibaram, it also says behibaram. He created the world with the letter hey. Rashi says it as well. Where does Avram get his hey from? From Sarai Imenu. This is incredible. Avram builds the world when he gets the hay from Sarah. Everything fits in. His ability to build comes from the hay that Sarah gave him. In other words, we have over here, Sarah takes something intimate from her essence, gives it over to her husband. Her husband says, now I can be effective. The point is that, as Dolly Parton would say, you've got to build your man. And that's the way it goes. But it clearly works both ways. This is the way it has to be. Each one has to be focused. What can I give for the other one to bring out what they're supposed to be bringing? I just want to say a little thing over here. This is just my own personal agenda. I never saw this anywhere, but I'm so, so definite and clear that I'm right. I once had the following situation. I hope this is politically correct for me to do over here. Please forgive me, but I'm just telling you what happened. Once upon a time, I spoke to a group who were not Orthodox. I don't remember the situation. And somehow, they asked me the following question. To me, the Birthright group, I don't remember what it was. They said to me, why is it in our Siddur, in our prayer book, it says, Baruch Atem Avram, the Sarah, the Kei Yitzchak, the Rivka, the Kei Yaakov. This is the first thing you can do if you want to check if it's an Orthodox Siddur, is you go to the Shimon Esrei and see they throw in the matriarchs. So Hashem gave me a moment of inspiration, plus a sick British humor, and I said the following. I said, I don't understand something. Why is it in your Siddur it says Avram and Sarah? When I grew up in England, it was always ladies first. Why did you write Avram and Sarah? Sarah and Avram, that would be more polite. I find this offensive. Okay, it's like, I don't know why it is that way. Why did they put Sarah second? Put her first, so they have nothing to answer. And now I'm going to tell you the real answer. Everywhere, throughout the Torah, and throughout Mishnah, wherever it is, whenever you see the word Avram, it always means Avram and Sarah. Except for when they're fighting, which we're going to talk about in a moment. except when there's a conflict. Avram does not exist without sorrow. Anyone that opens up Hasidus or mystical Sfarim, they know Avram and Sarah, you need both. Each one complements each other to create what Avram was trying to do. He needed Sarah and Sarah needed Avram, and they were working as a team. So why don't you mention Sarah? Because Sarah has no ego. Sarah is in the proverbial tense. She says, okay, you mentioned my husband, you've mentioned me. I know that. I don't need to have my name in lights. So that is, Sarah Menu says, you mentioned Avram, you've mentioned me. It's always that. When you say in your prayers, Elkei Avram, Elkei Yitzchak, Elkei, you have mentioned the matriarchs. They are a team. They are two halves of a whole. They always come together. Okay. Next thing. Now that I've told you that Sarah has the Dolly Parton instinct and she will stand by her man, you should know that it's not really, really true what I'm saying. Because Sarah Menu, boy, can she be assertive. And this is something to know in life when you feel yourself has made a mistake, you speak up. So what happened was, Avraham Avinu, for reasons that I'm not going to explain now because it's not a Chumash class, Avraham Avinu believed in Ishmael. He had a plan for Ishmael. The Vilna Gaon has a whole essay about Avraham Avinu's belief in Ishmael. Definitely another class for another time. But Avraham Avinu is very, very emotionally and philosophically invested in Ishmael. Ishmael has a role to play. Okay, I mean, when it comes to the Akedah, he doesn't know. He says, give me your one son, your beloved son, until the very end, until he actually, Hashem says, Yitzchak, Avraham Avinu is still holding on to the vision that it's going to be Ishmael. Okay, so Sarah sees past Ishmael and through Ishmael and says, V'tayimel Avram, Garish ha'am ha'zeis, V'esbana, etc., etc., Dayera hadava ma'od de'ene Avram. He doesn't care. She doesn't care. Her husband says, you're wrong. And Sarah says, I'm right. And we have tension in the home of Abraham and Sarah. Well, in those days, the concept of therapy had not been invented yet. So guess what? Who comes in? The answer is Hashem comes in. But before Hashem comes in, I want to read to you the following medrash from Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer. Because, especially for the men folk out there, because we're the ones that have this problem, and I'm allowed to say it because I'm male. It's like one of those things, it's like African Americans can say words that I'm not allowed to say. It's a certain thing, so I can make fun of my gender. Here we go. The ninth test. Omar Sarah, right out of Get, and get rid of this Omar, get rid of this woman, Hagar, and get rid of her son, and get him out of her house. And we leave me just Isaac, my son. And then he says, and I want him out of this world, and I want him out of the next world, which means that's it. Ishmael is out of everything. He doesn't get this world. There's no Ishmael in Olam Haba. Phew. Okay, Baruch Hashem. Thank you. Okay. So there was. When the call arrives to Baal al Avram, Hira be'ena hadavar zeh. Whoops, let me read this slowly. This is supposed to be dramatic now. Oh, Mikol Haroi Shabbat, and all the terrible things that happened in Abraham's life, this was the toughest of them all. Okay, now I don't know what you and I would say. If I would ask you, what was Abraham's toughest moment? I would say the Akedah. No, something like the binding of Isaac, giving up your firstborn son, and everything that he stands for, losing the Jewish people. No, getting rid of Ishmael was the hardest thing of all. So, without discussing why Avraham Avinu felt this way, you should all know, meaning we should all know, that Avraham Avinu understood that something huge had happened. My whole life, I believed in something. And now I realize that my life viewpoint has been wrong, and now I've got to change it. This took guts for Avraham Avinu to recognize that what he thought, his vision for Ishmael, is that he was wrong. And he stepped down, and he says, okay, it wasn't that he agreed to his wife because he wanted to have Shalom by it. He agreed to his wife because it suddenly crashed and dawned onto him that Hashem is telling him, you've made a miscalculation in your life. And sometimes in life, people have to switch courses. And sometimes people have to realize that the vision that they had was the wrong vision. And that takes tremendous guts. But Avraham Avinu did that. Sarah Imenu had to teach him. Hashem had to step in. And then Avraham Avinu switched courses and realized that what he had done was actually wrong. Next. The Ramban tells us another important point about marriage. Big decisions are always made together. Who was supposed to kick out? Who was supposed to, excuse me, this goes back a little bit to the beginning of the story. When Hagar came into the Abraham-Sarah household, who brought her in? Sarah brought her in. So Ramban says, why Sarah? So he says the following words. He says, "La'idia shleimir Avraham l'dava ad shalacha Sarai v'nasne b'cheiko." He would not do anything until he knew that Sarah, meaning, was 100% okay with what had happened. So sometimes a spouse wants something badly and sort of like becomes a little pushy and we're both guilty of this. We can nag our spouse into submission if you really want something. I don't want to get into trouble. I think one gender is a little bit better than the other one. But we can do these things. We are capable if we want something. But that's not the goal over here. The goal is to win the argument. And then when you know that your spouse is with you, then you can move ahead. This is going to be a huge thing. It's kind of awkward because this whole thing about concubines is a little creepy for me because you and I can't relate to that ancient society. There's a lot to talk about what it means over here. But yeah, the whole concubine, no, I don't really get the whole thing. I understand philosophically, but it's hard to relate to this whole thing. But Sarah Imenu was 100% behind everything that was going on over here. Now comes the last few points, and these are the most important of all. Everything is basically a build-up to what I want to say now. Yesterday, I was in between a little bit. I was looking at, okay, when I'm on the road, I have no idea what's going on. But yesterday, I read the parsha, and I saw something that I'd never seen before. And I said, yeah, I'm going to mention this tonight. I just saw this yesterday. I had no one to tell, so you have to hear this. What's the opening verse of yesterday's parasha? Vayu chaye Sarah, mea shana. Sarah lived 100 years. Asirin v'shevach shana, hayu yirmei Sarah. The days of her life were 27 years. Actually, if you read the whole thing, it says her life was 127 years. But the verse is broken down as if to say, says the Aruch Chaim HaKadosh, as if to say, she lived 100 years, and then her days of her life was 27. It was really 127. Says the Aruch Chaim HaKadosh, listen to how to read this verse. Vahiyu is always expression of sadness. He brings proofs. So he says, 100 years Sarah was sad, 27 years she really lived. So what happened on the day that Sarah turned 100? He brings down the measure. Well, no, that's when she was 90. So what happened on her 100? Because I always thought, yeah, that makes sense. Okay, so she got Yitzchak, she's now happy, she got a kid. What happened when she turned 100? Well, yes, that's when she got rid of Yishmael. You know why? Says the Aruch Chaim HaKadosh, because as long as Ishmael is in the household, there's always the possibility that he will negatively affect Yitzchak, and if Yitzchak does not become who she wants it to become, she's not going to have any inner peace. The inner peace came when Ishmael was out the house. Okay, talk about a focused educator. This is something incredible. She only became a happy camper. In other words, she only started to live when she had a son, and the son was in a safe home environment. And this is something huge. This is something needs, for all of us, including myself, we need to have class after class and reminder after reminder about what this means. That Avraham Avinu and Sarah Imenu understood a basic principle of a Jewish home. Kedusha, sanctity, is more important than anything else. This is the foundation of the Jewish home. And I want to show you how extreme this is. Because this is a question that bothered me. For years it's bothered me until I realized that the answer was just staring me in the face. Avraham and Sarah were extraordinarily rich. They were a superpower. Everyone was looking at them. They were very, 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 very rich. And they could afford to do, like we know, when they married off Yitzchak, they sent Eliezer with all these silver and gold and gifts and all kinds of things. They were very, very rich. Now, Yishmael is about to be sent out of the house with his mother, Hagar. And this is going to be it. Hagar in those days was the Kim Kardashian of Egypt, if you wish. Okay, that was it. She was the one that was... She had her day. She was the one that was famous for being famous and everything like that. But you know what? Ishmael, this was the one that was living in Avram Avinu's house. Give him something. Within a few days, we see, before we know it, the Torah says that he's literally dying from thirst in the desert. Surely they saw what was going to happen. Why didn't they give them like some servants, and why didn't they give them some like food and take care of them? You know, we're going to kick you out of the house, but we don't need you to die. By the way, living in Israel, sometimes I wish that whatever, it's too late. Ishmael's here to be a pain in the derriere of humanity until the end of days. That's what happened at that point then, when the Malach came along, when the angel gave this blessing to Ishmael. But the point I want to make is that Sarah and Avraham Avinu kicked him out immediately without an extra second. And here's the point I want to make. The moment that Avraham Avinu and Sarah had that moment of clarity that Ishmael was a bad influence on Yitzchak, they realized that every second that he is in their home will negatively affect their son. You can't say, you know what? I'll wait till next week to put the filters on my internet. It doesn't work that way. Because how long does it take to mess up the 10-year-old boy's brain? Unfortunately, I don't know. I hope you don't know. But I'm the one to deal with the rubbish. When the boys come to Israel, and their brains are basically sewers because they didn't have a proper filter on their internet at home, and then, thank God, the Talmud is the ultimate draino for the sick, demented, teenage Jewish boy's brain. And yeshiva helps them a lot. It does help them. But until they get there, so what happened was, okay, so the parents say, okay, we got to put a filter. Well, hello, where have you been till now? The moment your kid, the hormones kick in, you've got to make sure that your home is a safe environment. You can't always protect your kids forever and ever, but in the home has to be safe environment. The home has to be a place of Kedusha. It's a very, very scary world out there. And I'm telling you, because I have a lot of friends that work with yeshiva kids in high schools, and they are clueless as to how to find solutions to these problems. We have a psychologist over here who's nodding her head. It's just like, I don't know, this is the biggest problem in education today in the yeshiva world. The yeshiva world is much better off than the rest of the world, but it's still a terrible, terrible, terrible situation. One thing we see over here, you don't wait. The first second, Sarah Imenu understood the moment you realize that Yishmael is the unfiltered internet of our home, you got to take care of it straight away. Now, I can prove to you I'm right, because years later, when Rivka comes into the home of Yitzhak Avinu, so this is actually this week's parsha. So, excuse me, at the end of last week's parasha. So what does Rivka, what happens when Rivka comes to the house? It says the light that Sarah Imenu had in her home relit itself on its own. So what kind of a light was that? Was it kind of magic light? Is that Harry Potter scene? What's happening over here? Where does this come from? Oh, okay. So no, this was going on all 7 days of the week. This was something that Sarah Imenu had the merit that as long as she was in the tent of Abraham together, Aaron and Abraham, there was this light. This light came from a holy source. This is the same thing as the light, the ancient light that was hidden at the beginning of creation. There was a teeny glimmer that Sarah Imenu brought into her home. How did she do that? Because she was the first Yiddish Balabusta, the first Jewish housewife, the first Jewish home builder, and she built everything around Kedusha and holiness, and therefore there was this light of holiness that she brought into this home. And that was her whole focus. And with that, it was her educational philosophy for Yitzchak, that Yitzchak had to be an extension of that Kedusha. We're almost there. Here's another question that bothered me for years, and I found out an answer about 5 years ago. The angels come to visit Avram and Sarah. The angels come along and say, Abraham, where's your wife? And Abraham says, she's inside the tent. And Rashi asks the question, duh, you're angels. You couldn't figure this out on your own. What were they doing over here? So what does Rashi answer? Ding, ding, ding. Remember from high school, ladies and gentlemen, what you learned? Go for it.
There was like a complimentary.
There we go. Okay. Great school you go to. Because the angels were trying to improve Avram and Sarah's marriage by reminding Avram Avinu what an incredible wife you have. Here you have these good-looking angels coming in. And you expect in a ceremony, you say, so what's your name? Okay? It's not what happened. Okay? She's minding her own, she's inside the tent. She's not stepping out. So, this was the angel's way of reminding Avram Avinu how fortunate he was to have a wife that was filled with this modesty. Hello, we're talking about Avram and Sarah. Avram Avinu is a therapist, needs to be reminded. He needs to remind himself how lucky he is to have his wife. Well, guess what? The answer is yes. No matter how incredible you are, you can never stop reminding yourself of the way we started the class, of how lucky you are to have your spouse. This is what happens. You take things for granted and you forget how lucky you are. You just think, okay, I guess this is the way it is. And this is how things go stale. You can never, ever have enough compliments for your spouse. And you can never stop reminding yourself of how lucky you are to have who you are. So this is something that we can learn from Avram and Sarah as well. Finally, the last two ideas are as follows. Avram Avinu says the famous words, "V'anochi afar ve'efer." I am ashes and I am dust. So it sounds like, okay, I keep mentioning the therapy word, but here again, you know, you have to give self-esteem issues. This isn't a problem. This is it. The point is as follows. Avram Avinu and Sarah Imenu, with everything I've said till now, they had a sense of perspective. They were probably the greatest couple of all time. Avram Avinu, arguably, had more impact than any other human being did any time, in any place, in all of history, unless you want to say Moshe Rabbeinu. But in a sense, Avram Avinu taught the world in terms of the planet. Abraham is the one that did more than anyone else. And his self-perception is that I am Ofer Be'efa. What does this mean? The sense is as follows. Everyone has egos. And egos, probably our psychologist friends will say over here, a little bit is probably healthy because it's good for self-esteem. It's good for self-esteem if you need it. But if a person has incredible, natural self-esteem because you believe in yourself and you believe what you're doing, then you understand that in truth we're all nothing. What does it mean we're all nothing? Here is a parable that I made up. I think it's a very good parable. Once upon a time, in the king's palace, two people were having an argument. One was the royal gardener and one was the royal chambermaid. And she says, I'm better than you because I clean up the king's bedroom. The other one says, I'm better than you because I make everything beautiful. I make the whole palace beautiful. And they're arguing back and forth. And then, as they're arguing, the king comes in. And they'll stand to attention. Who is the one that is right at that moment? No one. They're just servants of the king. It's all about the king. Everything revolves around the king. So Avram Avinu and Sarah Imenu, they understood that what they were doing was focused on what Hashem wanted. So they had this incredible, natural self-esteem that translated in, it's not about us, it's all about Hashem. And this is something that we have to remind ourselves. We're building a home for Him. We are soldiers in His army. We are building a microcosm of the Jewish temple, which in turn is a microcosm of the Jewish home, and we're all doing it for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we're all doing it on His behalf. It's a tremendous privilege, but it also gives you a sense of perspective. It's not about us, it's all about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What we're doing is for Him and only for Him. And finally, number 10 is that another thing that we always forget. Judaism has three homes. One is called the Jewish home. One is called the home or the bayit of Torah study, which is where we are now. And one, which is right next door, is the place of prayer. The Judaism has made out of three pillars: Chesed, which is the Jewish home; Torah, which is the Beit Midrash; and Tefillah, which is the Beit Knesset. Which is the most important of the three? So Avram Avinu and Sarah clearly had an answer. it's all about the home. And the Rambam, Maimonides, actually says this because the way he describes Torah and Tefillah are these huge electrical generators that are the ones that are there to feed the Jewish home, to turn the home into what it's supposed to be. But in the end, what we do here on this world is build homes. Prayer and Torah study is the generators that make us able to do it. But the goal is the Jewish home. How does Maimonides say it? Maimonides says it when he talks about the mitzvah of mezuzah. Most people think, correctly, by the way, that the mezuzah, you kiss it on the way out. You ask Hashem to help you on your journey. But the Rambam doesn't say that at all. The Rambam says the purpose of the mezuzah is when you go into the Jewish home, know that the home that you're about to enter is not a place for relaxation. Doesn't mean you can't relax, doesn't mean you can't have laughter and can't have fun, but that's not the purpose of the home. You come into a Jewish home and you say to yourself, this is where I build my life. And everything I do is important. And every part of the Jewish home is significant. It doesn't make any difference where I am, whether it's the bedroom, or it's the living room, or it's the kitchen, or whether it's whatever, it's the dining room, all these places that I'm doing, I'm a builder. And when you come in, the Rambam uses the same language as he uses when he describes the power of the shofar. He says the shofar is a wake-up call. Uru, uru, mishnachem, wake up from your slumber. And he uses the same phrase when he talks about the mezuzah. The mezuzah is a wake-up call that you shouldn't get confused about heavily hazman, about the vanities of time. And some people think you come in the home, and the, you know, the home is where you get your food, and then you catch the remote control and everything like that. And I'm not saying you shouldn't be doing these things, because everyone needs to relax, and everyone needs to enjoy good cooking, but that's not the point of the home. The point is that you're trying to build something. The point is that you're trying to build something that plugs into something eternal. And with that, I would like to conclude and say the following thing, and this is really, I'm really ending, because I've said everything I wanted to say, but I just want to finish off with one little reflection. And that is, this year I learned something. This year, I sat shiva for my father, and for 7 days, I increased my knowledge of my father by about tenfold. Because my father was a person that went through the Holocaust and didn't talk. He didn't say what he did. Most of the time in the Holocaust, he was actually saving Jewish lives. That's what he was doing. I found out, one of my father's cousins gave me the book about the Baba Rebbe and says, go to this page and you'll see how your father saved the Baba Rebbe's life. I never heard about this until this year. And then the next person comes in and says, yeah, in 1948, he was in the Haganah and he was in the Mossad for 10 years. And I heard rumors about this, but he started saying all the things that he did. And I started to realize that, wow, this is incredible. And then I remembered how lucky it was my father met my mother in Italy. Why was my mother in Italy? It's very simple. Because after the war, my mother was this German girl living in London. And she heard about all the terrible things that were happening with the refugees after the war. And she said, I'm going to go to Italy and try and help out. And she ended up for 5 years taking care of 200 orphans. And that's how she met my dad. And they were both doing chesed, building. And they were... I did not really appreciate until much, much later in my life how extraordinary these people were. And when the shiva was over, I did the following thing, and I think what I said is right. But this is how I felt, as though I still feel. After the shiva, I sat down with my wife and my kids, and I said, you know, for a whole week, we've been saying Hespedim, and people tell us stories, and everyone says how great your parents were and how they inspired, and I want to tell you a little secret. My heart tells me that when... within a couple of years, everyone will have forgotten my parents and my wife's mother, who also passed. We forget. You know, you read a beautiful memory of somebody in the Mishpacha magazine, or whatever it's called, an obituary about an inspiring person. You read a book about an inspiring person, then you put the book down, and you've forgotten about the person. Well, you know who never forgets. There's only one type of person that will never forget, and that is the children. They will not forget us. The only ones that will take our legacy and really try and copy what we were all about, what we stood for, is what we pass to our children. That's all we have. Everything else we do in this world, if we're lucky, we can become a statistic. Or as my rabbi would say, sometimes we can even become a road. And he said, you know, in Israel, you know, saying, you know, that's what I have. You become a road. That's what it is. But that's it. It doesn't make it. That's all you can become. But people will forget. sometimes you become, you know, whatever, they'll learn about you in history class, but no one cares about that person as a person, except for your children. For the children, yeah, these are our parents. This is our legacy. This is what we're all about. This is where we come. This is our roots. That is eternal. And that is something that we can hold on to. And we all live in a society that's constantly saying to us, you know what, why don't you make an impact here, an impact there? Why don't you change this part, change this thing? And we forget that everything that we're supposed to be doing with our life is really in our homes. Recently, my wife and I went through a middle-age switch. And what happened was, in the beginning, we made a bunch of weddings. With weddings, we have young couples and grandchildren and things like that. Our home was always supposed to be the Avram and Sarah home. But it's not anymore. It became, the last 2-3 years, it became a Yaakov Avinu home. We have at most 2 guests at a meal, just no room anymore. It just changed. And our whole focus, my wife and I, instead of saying, what can we do for our students? I don't want to sound like we're callous, but we've got too much going on. And then we realize this is really the most important thing in our lives, is our kids. And if you have everything right in your life, except for your home, you have nothing right in your life. You've missed the whole point. You've missed the plot. You can have the most incredible careers and you could be out there. But you know what? One day they'll bury you and it's all forgotten. But your wife and your children, your spouse and your kids, they will remember you. And they will pass on your legacy. So let's go back to the beginning of everything I said tonight. And it's all the same idea. Avram and Sarah, that's what they did. In the end, yeah, they changed the world. But really, what they did was for their children. And that's us. And our job is to make sure that we build our own microcosmic expression of what Avram and Sarah did in our own homes. And Hashem, at least since I came from Jerusalem 3 days ago, Hashem should give you all the blessing that you should see, not just nachas, and not just the pleasure of seeing the fruits of your doing, but you should appreciate how fortunate we are to be able to be doing this beautiful endeavor. Thank you for listening. Okay. Thank you.
Oh, nice to meet you.
So much. I just want to mention that when I listen to things, it inspires me and comes back to us. So.